A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 33. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Children of the Stones. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England.
A scientist called Adam Brake and his son Matthew arrive in a small village called Milbury, and they find that something is not quite right with the villagers as they arrive. They seem unnaturally calm and claim to be happy, although they don't seem to be happy. And why they're like this, they really don't know. Does the circle of stones that surround the village have something to do with it? Well, they don't know that either.
So Children of Stones was a 1976 production by one of the independent television companies in the UK called HTV. And they produced a 7-part series, produced and directed by a chap called Peter Graham Scott, who we'll talk about in a moment. And it had a very impressive, quite high-powered cast for a children's TV series. And then it was broadcast the following year, 1977 was when it first went out. And it was put out sort of like right in typical children's TV time. It went out at about 4:15 in the afternoon in January and February of that year for these 7 episodes, which they're all about 25 minutes or so. So they're not terribly long, particularly with the commercial breaks in there.
It was also shown in the US on Nickelodeon as part of a series called The Third Eye, which was one of the first programs that Nickelodeon was running. And that was broadcast a few years later there in the early 80s.
And it was, as we were going to discuss, quite a scary show. It was a very interesting show for children's TV because it has got an awful lot going on. It's got some quite difficult stuff to understand. It's certainly not an easy storyline, and the ideas involved are quite complex, and it was very creepy, and it's still remembered by a lot of people as one of the sort of creepiest and scariest things they saw on television when they were kids. So it had quite a big impact.
You may have gathered by now that Eamon and I are both fans of shows that are safe for children but are also scary.
Yep, the scary stuff.
Now there's an interesting list of characters here. We have Adam Brake, the astrophysicist that we mentioned earlier, and he is in Milbury to research the stones. He is studying how they align with the stars and the magnetic properties and so on. And this is all because the stones, which were set up in Neolithic times, often have these types of properties relating to the stars. Adam Brake was played by Gareth Thomas, who went on shortly after Children of the Stones to play Blake in Blake 7. So he's very well known from that.
And as you said, he comes to the village with his son Matthew, played by a child actor called Peter Demin. There's no mum on the scene. I think we get the impression that Adam Brake is sort of widowed. So there's no mother. There's just him and his son. Matthew, his son, is also a bit of a maths wizard himself, as we find. He's got certain skills in maths and physics, which he's obviously got from his dad, which will come in useful as the story progresses.
They do say at one point early in the story that Matthew's mother had died a couple of years earlier.
Right. That explains why they're on their own.
That's right. We also have Margaret, played by Veronica Strong, who was the local librarian and historian and ran the museum in Milbury. And she had arrived there recently. She was also a widow, and she came with her daughter, Sandra, played by Catherine Levy. So there was a bit of a symmetry here with Margaret and Sandra being one pair of people, and then Adam and Matthew being the other pair of people. And all of them play off one another very well.
And then also they're going to meet some of the locals in the village. And in particular, very early on, we meet one of the sort of dominant local characters, a character called Raphael Hendrick, who seems to be the sort of leader of the community in the village. He lives in the big manor house. He's sort of like the squire of the village. He owns the cottage that Matthew and Adam rent. And when we first meet him, he's a very sort of benign and charming character, played by a very tall and imposing actor called Ian Cuthbertson, who has been in lots of British television. He was very famous for playing a sort of gangster in a program called Budgie. And then for British Invaders sort of genre stuff, he'd been in a show called The Stone Tape, which we will be discussing on another episode, which was also memorably creepy. And he's been in some other British Invaders type stuff over the years as well.
Yes, he was in Casting the Ruins.
Yep, that's it.
And he's played villains in a lot of series. Hendrik in Children of the Stones was a very imposing character, and right from the beginning, he has a very imposing, mysterious feel that becomes a very strong part of the story. We also meet Di, the poacher, and he is sort of a homeless character. He lives in this old stone structure called the Sanctuary that is sort of connected to the stones in its own way. Di basically hunts and gathers for his own food, and he is also a somewhat mysterious character who seems to understand what is going on in Milbury and why things are strange and unusual much more than anyone else does. And he was played by Freddie Jones.
And he's a fantastic actor who's been in loads of genre stuff over the years. I guess he's probably best known for playing the rather villainous keeper of the Elephant Man in the film The Elephant Man.
What are these?
Oh, they're ley lines.
Ley lines, are they indeed? Tell me you believe in all that sort of thing.
I try to keep an open mind.
Oh, come on. Invisible straight lines that are supposed to connect ancient sacred places, churches, markstones, barrows...
And stone circles.
You're my idea of hell. Write out 100 ley lines.
I take it you're not a believer.
I'm a scientist. Scientists need proof.
Well, I can't offer you that, I'm afraid. But there are some interesting theories. Some people even believe that ley lines are power cables, and that the sacred places they connect are temples, built by Neolithic man as a storehouse of psychic energy.
So, Milbury's full of psychic energy, is it? Who traced out these lines?
Oh, various ley hunters. People who spend all their spare time looking for them. Some I worked out for myself.
How many are there?
53.
Interesting.
Why?
How many stones are left standing in the circle?
53.
So Adam and Matthew, they're in this village of Milbury, and as the title of the programme suggests, the village features and in fact is surrounded by a circle of ancient standing stones of a sort that's fairly common in England. Neolithic stone circles, there's quite a few of them around that have survived. Of course, the most famous one, the most well known, is Stonehenge, although it's not the oldest stone circle around, as we'll hear. So they're in this village which has got these weird ancient stones around it, and in fact in the village as well.
For people who are not familiar with these are not small little rocks. We're talking about very large pieces of stone that are standing upright that surround this village in a circle and have a further sort of avenue of stone stretching away from it. So it's quite an impressive thing to have there.
Yeah, they're about, some of them are 10 or 12 feet high, and they're obviously huge, as you say, quite imposing structures. And, you know, obviously a lot of mystery about how they were brought to these places and how they were put up, famously, as the various theories about Stonehenge.
Now, Adam Brake is in Milbury with Matthew to research the stones. As we said, he's an astrophysicist. He has a research grant to be there for something like 3 months to gather as much information as he can about these stones, about what they are doing in terms of the stars and their other properties, as well as what is below the ground in the same spot as the circle of stones. Now, he's doing this research, and his son Matthew is actually helping him quite a bit, and he is going to Margaret and getting help from her in order to get some historical information about it. So they're building up more of an idea about what's happening with the stones, and they gradually learn that there is more than you might expect. There's more than just a circle of stones, and they're doing something more than just pointing to the stars. There are also strange things happening with the people who are there.
So while that's going on, Matthew's also getting out and doing normal, you know, kid things that we'd expect him to do. So he's meeting the locals, and he's meeting some of the other kids, some of whom he gets on quite well with, including Margaret's daughter, Sandra, and then some of the other children children of the village he meets, perhaps he doesn't get on with quite so well. And at first it seems to be just typical stuff, disagreements about football teams and so on. And it all seems reasonably straightforward. He's introduced to the local school and the local school teacher, and there's perhaps something strange going on there in the classroom, which we'll mention in a moment. And then he also literally bumps into Di, this poacher character, this rather strange, cryptic character who pops up every now and then and seems a little bit confused and muddled and says some odd things and tells Matthew odd snippets of information, in particular about this place, the sanctuary where he lives, which he believes keeps him safe from something. So Matthew's sort of out and about bumping into people and finding out a bit more about the village.
And Matthew starts to realize very early on that there is something not normal about most of his classmates in the school. They are so calm as to be docile and seem to have no personality or emotion. They always say they're happy, but they seem to be very plain and have no personalities. They also seem to be abnormally skilled in mathematics, where Matthew is clearly a very gifted kid. He's very good at math. Some of the other students are far beyond even Matthew, and you see scenes of kids writing things down with ease on blackboards in differential calculus and integral calculus. It's quite interesting to see where they go with it.
It's quite bizarre, really, isn't it? It's a sort of completely weird educational streaming going on in this small village classroom where you've got these two groups of children. One group contains Matthew, who we'd think is exceptionally bright for his age, but he's sitting sort of open-mouthed looking at this other group of children who are very calm and content and happy and are performing this sort of genius level university standard advanced maths and physics calculations on the blackboard. So there's clearly something happening and something going on. And the other thing that we encounter quite early on is this: these happy villagers greeting each other and also greeting Adam and Matthew with this expression, happy day, which at first they think is a terribly sort of quaint local expression that everybody meets each other and says happy day and says the same as they part. But as it goes on, it seems to become more and more strange and unsettling, and seems to disturb them, gives them this idea that there's something unusual about these villagers.
It was definitely strange because you have these people that, yes, they always say happy day, but there's something always a little bit unsettling about them. And then you have Hendrik, who is apparently not affected by whatever affects all the other villagers. He seems much more normal emotionally, but he is also a very mysterious person who is very closed about things and obviously understands more than we do and isn't willing to say anything more about it. He's quite a creepy sort of character.
He's very much so, isn't he? I mean, as I say, he starts out relatively benign and charming, and I think he almost we don't see him much in the second episode, but when he reappears in the sort of middle of the series, he's growing increasingly mysterious and creepy. And as I say, Ian Cuthbertson, very tall, very dramatic, imposing actor. So it's all it's all building up quite nicely. And we've got these strange villagers and their strange encounters. And then we've got the stones themselves, which are also mysterious. And quite early on, I think in the end of the first episode, Margaret says to the scientist, Adam, you know, have you touched one of the stones? He can't quite see what she's getting at. So she takes him out to the circle and gets him to touch one of the stones. And of course, it has a very dramatic effect and leads Adam, the man of science, trying to come up with various theories as to what power these stones have. He believes it's some form of electromagnetic power. But as the series progresses, he also starts to discuss whether or not this is some form of psychic power.
That is the point where they start to set up the conflict of these psychic and paranormal explanations versus the scientific explanations. And that is a major theme that runs through this show. Can we talk about this in terms of physics and electromagnetism and all these other things? Or do we have to start talking about psychic phenomena and paranormal things and these sorts of things? And it never goes entirely one way or the other. And that's something that works very well in this show.
Yeah, it does. It ticks it along, doesn't it? It reminded me almost in a way of the X-Files, because we've got Adam Brake, this man of science with his gadgets and his technology and his monitoring equipment, but he's obviously also, he's open to the possibility of other or alternative explanations. And as you say, that starts to become more and more important as the series progresses and the mystery is building.
So does that make Adam Scully?
I think he's both. He does a bit of both. He's the science of Scully and the openness of Fox Mulder. There you are.
Okay. It also, as it develops and you have the happy day greeting showing up more and you start to see more of what villagers are like and Hendrik becomes more creepy, it becomes quite sinister what's going on here.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, on the production side, we have Jeremy Burnham and Trevor Ray were the writers, both former actors with genre credits, Burnham on The Avengers and Ray on Doctor Who, of course. The two of them worked to build this sort of very different program that would be quite challenging, but also be for children.
The show, as I've said, was produced and directed by a very sort of competent TV director called Peter Graham Scott, who had, again, he'd also worked in genre stuff. He'd done The Avengers. He'd done some episodes of The Prisoner. He'd also done a very famous long-running show about a sailing line called The Oneidan Line, which was very well known on British TV. He was offered this script by Burnham and Ray.
And apparently he was quite surprised looking at this script because it was set to be for children's TV and he couldn't believe that this was something you could use for a children's TV program. But in the end, he went with that and they made that work very well.
Absolutely, yeah. So that was, we'll discuss perhaps later, you know, how much of it is a children's TV, because it could work quite equally as adult TV.
Yes, that's true.
They got the go-ahead for the production and they went to the Wiltshire village of Avebury, which has the actual stone circle that's featured in the show. And so Avebury doubles as Milbury throughout the series, where they've actually got these Neolithic stones which are older than Stonehenge. So they had a perfect setting, really, for the series.
Yes, some people consider this fictional town of Milbury to be like a fictionalized version of Avebury, because you have that stone circle and it's that similar concept to what is actually there. It turned out they did want more stones and something more complete than what they had, so they used the real stones of Avebury and also built some fiberglass stones to supplement them, which look very good. I couldn't tell you which ones are the real ones and which ones are the fake ones. And the story is that even in person, it was sometimes hard to tell the difference between the real ones and the fiberglass ones. There was a story about an American tourist who leaned up against one of the fiberglass stones and knocked it over and was quite upset that she had knocked over this ancient Neolithic stone, until it was, of course, explained that that wasn't one of the real stones. That was just a dummy.
And as you say, they look absolutely fantastic, because you cannot tell which are the fake stones. They either were perfect models or they were perfectly shot to produce the effect.
I suspect it was a little of both.
Yeah. And as we've said, it was 1976, which was a very famously hot British summer. Quite an unusual thing, that, a hot British summer. But there you are, 1976, one of the hottest British summers on record. Always remembered by people because, you know, how long and roasting it was. And you can see that in some of the outdoor shots where it is clearly baking. And in actual fact, when they switched to some of the studio shots, it does look considerably cooler inside under the studio lights than it was in the outdoors, with some of the kids having to do all the running around and riding their bikes.
Yes, it does look very hot and sunny outside and in some of those sequences, which worked pretty well for this, I thought.
Yeah, you do get that feeling of this sort of like long, hot children's summer, and that's where the children's TV part really works, because it looks like another one of these shows about a child arriving in a new area and having to meet up with new friends. But as we've said, it's got all this creepy and spooky and mystery going on with it.
That's right. You often tend to think of creepy and mysterious television working especially well in fog or rain or nighttime, anything but full bright sun. And in this case, it really did work well with the bright sun, and that gave it part of its unique look.
Yeah.
Another thing that made it especially unique was the music that was composed by Sidney Sager. We haven't talked about the music yet, and it did play a big part in it, because they had this recording of a choral work that Sager had written for this that was wordless, but included these very open and eerie sounding harmonies, along with whispering and wailing and sort of wordless speech type sounds mixed into it. That gave you something that was very intense and creepy, and that became a theme for the stones themselves, and also in some ways a theme for the people of the village. It was very powerful and added a great deal to this series.
Exactly right, yes. Very powerful, be one way of putting it. I mean, two things about the theme that struck me. Firstly, it seems to me quite typical of the sort of late 70s and early 80s, that sort of choral music. I mean, I think we've heard similar when we discussed the theme music for the 1981 Day of the Triffid series. But the second thing about it is so spooky and unsettling. And as I watched the series quite recently, as the series progressed, I almost couldn't listen to the music. It was so disturbing in a way. It just makes you wonder how they got away with this for children's TV in the 1970s.
It was a very good choice what they used on there, no question.
Absolutely, yes. Just to round off the production notes, there was a novelization which was brought out by the two writers, Burnham and Ray, and that came out the same year as the show was released in 1977. And I think secondhand copies are still available out on the various sites, although we haven't been able to track one down ourselves. And whether that contains extra information about the mysterious stones, we're not sure. Perhaps somebody can let us know. So that'll probably do it for our discussions for the first part. In our next episode, we're going to continue talking about the series, and we're going to talk about the mysterious influence of the stones, which seems to be extending to more and more people.
We haven't told you much about the story of what happens here, and we're not going to give all of it away, but we will tell you some more. We'll tell you some things about the different theories that the characters have about what's happening and explaining the situation, and a bit about what it is they have to explain and why things are so strange there.
And we're also going to be discussing why this show was so scary and why it's remembered as such a unsettling and creepy show. So plenty to talk about.
Absolutely. There's some good stuff to talk about next time, for sure. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. You can now also find us at our new Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there, and we already have some good discussions going there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada saying happy day.
And until next time, this is goodbye from Eamon in England.